Hey, it's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Stephanie Elkins, host of Simply Folk, joins us to share some music with deep roots in poetry.
First, WPR's Chapter Day will begin featuring a new book on Monday. It's called Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. It's also this year's Go Big Read Choice at UW-Madison.
The book is the memoir of an African-American lawyer and social justice activist as he helps African-Americans caught up, often unfairly, in the criminal justice system in the Deep South. WPR's own Cynthia Woodland reads the book here on the Ideas Network. She joins us now to talk about it. Cynthia, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how did you come across this book, Just Mercy?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I was here at Public Radio, and I was walking by the break room, and there were some photos that caught my eye, and it ended up being an annual report, which is weird. I know that sounds like makes me sound really geeky, but there was something about it that drew me to it, and I started flipping through the pages and reading about this organization called the Equal Justice Initiative, and then it was alluding to this book that the founder of the organization had written, Just Mercy, but the book wasn't there. So I went to Steve Paulson's office, because we know he has 10,000 books, and sure enough, he had the book, and I asked him if I could borrow it, and he didn't want to let me borrow it, because I think he wanted to do something with it, but he saw the look in my eye, and so he gave me the book.
Well, tell us what the book is about. What is Just Mercy telling us?
Just Mercy was written by Brian Stevenson, and it's his journey, starting out as a young, disillusioned law student, feeling kind of disconnected from the community, until he goes and does an internship down south working with death row inmates. And that changed his life and he ended up basing his whole life's work on working on behalf of the poor and the condemned. So the book is about his journey, about the people that he meets along the way. It gives some startling statistics about mass incarceration in the United States and all kinds of really important issues. So that's what it's about.
And this is work for him, and it's an issue, and it seems like it's very personal. He's in contact with people who he helps get exonerated till they die in some cases.
Absolutely.
So why did you choose this for Chapter a Day? Why was this one you wanted to share with our listeners?
I just feel like it's so important for where we are as a country right now. In America, we have the highest rate of incarceration in the world, and I think it's important for where we are as a state with the racial disparities and, you know, the high numbers of African-American men that are in prisons in Wisconsin, disproportionate rates compared to the rest of the country. I think it's important for us to be thinking about these things now.
Well, tell us, is there a particular story of a person that Brian Stevenson worked with that sticks out in your mind?
There are so many. Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, you know, we read excerpts on Chapter a Day, and so I follow the story of one African-American man, Walter McMillan, who was wrongly convicted of murder and spent 6 years on death row. And so throughout the book, Brian is talking about his story, and I thought it was important to follow that story all the way through. But there were a couple of stories, the ones involving children, that just really got me, that I just felt like it was really important for people to hear.
And looking back at that story and some of the others, the idea the story is telling is how the deck in the justice system is stacked against African-Americans, young and older, too. Mm-hmm. That comes out in the story you just mentioned.
Absolutely. And also poor people and people that don't have money for the proper legal representation. There are so many issues that go into it.
Well, this, you know, we're having the Black Lives Matter, a movement going on in Wisconsin, around the country now. These stories, do you see them as relevant to this conversation that people are having right now?
Absolutely relevant. Absolutely relevant.
How so? I mean, why? What should we be looking at in these stories and thinking about?
Well, when you asked me about a couple of stories that stood out mm-hmm. to me, I did not realize before reading this book that there are hundreds of children that are languishing in American prisons. I did not know that there are hundreds of children that have been sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. I didn't know that there were children who were being executed in the United States. When you hear about the stories of these children, many of them are black, they're Latino, they're poor. They find themselves on the wrong side of justice. And many of the things that are happening in our society now could be in the book. I mean, they could be stories in this book. And they are.
So you have an emotional connection to this book from the moment you read about it in that annual report through reading. Can you talk about your emotional response to Just Mercy?
Well, I think the approach that Bryan Stevenson takes is he talks about it from the perspective of our shared humanity. He doesn't really single anyone out. He has us all ask questions about ourselves as we look at the horrifying statistics about mass incarceration in this country. And he has us ask questions like, you know, why is this okay that we do this? Why are we so harsh with one another? And I just feel like, even from listening to radio shows here, whenever you talk about the death penalty or people that are in prison, it's almost like the wolves come out and people's fangs come out and they start getting really vicious and acting as if people's lives, if they've become involved with corrections, don't matter. You know, that they're not really human. So it doesn't matter how they're treated. It doesn't matter what has happened to them. It just seems like we're just too quick to throw people away as a society. And so I've always been concerned about that. And then my own son went to prison as a young person, spent 8 years in prison, was sentenced to 13 years of probation on top of that he's still, you know, still dealing with now. So when you have a loved one that has been incarcerated, you know, it hits you a little bit closer to home. But this book really shows how it's an issue for all of us.
Have we given up on the idea of redemption? I mean, I've heard similar things from callers who have been in prison themselves or have had relatives imprisoned. And the idea, the feeling that it's done. There's not a second chapter once that happens.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about Bryan Stevenson. He quotes Thomas Merton in the book, who said, "We are bodies of broken bones." Can I read a part of this?
Sure, please.
He says, "I guess I'd always known but never fully considered that being broken is what makes us human. We all have our reasons. Sometimes we're fractured by the choices we make. Sometimes we're shattered by things we never would have chosen. But our brokenness is also the source of our common humanity, the basis of our shared search for comfort, meaning, and healing. Our shared vulnerability and imperfection nurtures and sustains our capacity for compassion." So basically he's saying we're all broken. And some people's brokenness is more visible than others, but does that make it, are we better because our brokenness is different? And so he's asking those kinds of questions of people.
Another response I think people might have is, this is an issue. It's statistics, it's numbers. Oh, that's a lot of people in prison. How important is it, do you think, to hear personal stories like Bryan Stevenson's sharing or the story you shared with us?
I think it's absolutely important because I think when you hear statistics, you can just tune it out. Yeah, I've heard that before, but if it feels like it's not impacting you personally, so what? Lock them up and throw away the key. But when you start hearing people's stories, and when you start hearing about children and others who've been wrongly convicted, and when you start hearing the reality, you know, that we have more people incarcerated than any country in the world. I mean, it's eye-opening, it's startling, and we need, as responsible citizens, to be thinking about these things. You cannot disconnect from it.
Bryan Stevenson has seen some of the worst stories in our justice system. Reading the book, do you get a sense of hope from it or optimism?
That's another thing that I love about it. I love this man after reading this book. But that's one of the things that I love about him is that through going through the journey of the book, which can be very emotional, very hard to read at times, hard to hear at times, but important nonetheless, is that in spite of all that, he still has hope in who we can be. And hope that he encourages us to love each other and care about each other and to extend mercy. And he talks about how we all need mercy. I think all of us could, if we thought about it, would probably agree that we have needed mercy in our lives. So his question is, why don't we extend that to others?
After you selected this for Chapter a Day, it also became a UW-Madison selection, the Madison selection for the UW Go Big Read, where they encourage lots of people, libraries, stock up on copies of this. It doesn't sound like an easy-breezy kind of read. Can you make the case that, hey, this is worth checking out?
Absolutely. It is a life-changing book. It's the kind of thing where you read it and you're startled, you're horrified, your eyes are open because maybe you never knew that things were as bad as they are. But then when you hear people's stories, it just draws you in and you become part of the story. And I absolutely think it's and this is why I wanted to read it for Chapter a Day. I absolutely feel like everyone should read this book because of what it might do to you, for you, as a human being.
As part of Go Big Read, Brian Stevenson is coming to Madison. I know you're hoping to have a chance. I mean, what would you want to say to him if you have that chance?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many dear stories in the book of his encounters with especially like older African-American women who just kind of take him under their wing because they see how good he is and what he's trying to do. So ever since I read this book, I just it might sound a little hokey or whatever, but I just want to hug him because he's such a dear soul for the work that he's doing. I just want to hug him and thank him for what he's doing.
How often is it that there's a book that someone has this kind of connection with? I don't know. I'd have to think really hard. This doesn't come along very often.
Not very often at all, which is why I really rallied to have this book. I mean, you have to get the rights from the publisher, and they weren't getting back to us. And I kept going back and saying, can you ask again? Can you please just ask again? Because I just felt like people need to hear this.
Cynthia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking to WPR's Cynthia Woodland about the book Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. It'll be featured on WPR's Chapter a Day starting Monday at 12:30 p.m.
Of the Bard, whose present, past, and future sees.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. That's the music of Martha Redbone, inspired by the poet William Blake. Just one example of what turns out to be a lot of recent music with a strong poetical inspiration.
Stephanie Elkins joins us now to share some great music, mostly folk music, that has poetry at its heart. Stephanie is the host of Morning Classics and Simply Folk here at WPR. Stephanie, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, so Stephanie, what inspired you to tackle music inspired by poetry like this?
Well, a couple of new releases came into the library just in the past few weeks, and I sort of raised my eyebrows, now what's going on here, and then realized that there really is a large body of work, plus the Wisconsin Book Festival is coming up and there's a lot of poetry involved in that. That's next week, so I thought it might make a nice theme.
Well, we heard the Martha Redbone Roots Project. Tell us about this album. I guess it's inspired by the poet William Blake.
That's right. Apparently this book was on the shelf and it inspired her. She opened it up, and the one poem was called A Poison Tree. And that was the first one. It just really sucked her right in, and she really became entranced by his poetry. It's very spiritual, and so she's made a whole CD full of the poetry of William Blake.
And you've also got some Wisconsin artists to share with us, including one that features former poet laureate of Wisconsin, Max Garland. Who are the Eggplant Heroes?
The Eggplant Heroes. You know, I've got to wonder about the... I've asked them to come down and talk to us on Simply Folk. Got to ask about that name. But they're based in Eau Claire, and it's four guys that have gotten together. Duffy Duffhausen, Joel Pace, Olaf Lind, and Max Garland. And they do everything, including... literary adaptations and mountain gospel, and they have trumpet and violin, and they do some really cool music.
Well, let's give a listen to one of the tracks. This one is called Winter Light.
Don't fall the night, I'm not ready. Winter light, I'm not ready. Winter.
And that one is really evocative, and it's fall as we listen to this now. As I read those lyrics and listened to it just now, I thought, I'm not ready for winter light either. I totally understand where that was coming from. Gets it something.
I was listening to this song and reading these lyrics, and, you know, I'm not ready for winter light. And we had all that heavy wind a few days ago, and so many leaves came down. And then the refrain is, the leaves come down, they were the best part of me, and all of a sudden becomes a whole nother layer of meaning. Mm. And, boy, it's a really neat song.
Well, the deck is kind of stacked there when you've got the state poet laureate in your band. It's going to be kind of poetical, isn't it?
It really is. And that's a song with a lot of layers and some beautiful harmonies. It's a great song.
And you gave us a more classical arrangement. There's one called Why I Wake Early. This is from an ensemble from Boston. This one not from Wisconsin. This is called Coro Allegro.
They are made up of members and friends of the LGBT community there. And it's a great chorus. And this is another new release that came into our library recently. And this is a piece of music that's by composer Ronald Pereira. He's a classical composer, and he has set the poetry of Mary Oliver to to music, and she's really inspired by nature. And we're going to hear a song called Why I Wake Early, and it's just one of these great songs that when it comes to the climax, which is good morning, good morning, you just want to stand up and say good morning, sun. This is really a happy song.
Let's get a taste of that. So when you're taking existing texts and setting them to music, it seems like that for a composer or a songwriter, however you want to think of it, lends a built-in rhythm. It's something you can build the music around.
Absolutely. Like right now we're hearing Good Morning, and he's layered these chords in such a way that it takes her rhythm, and it also expresses the definition, it expresses the meaning of the words. And so when you get the marriage of the words and the music in a special way, it can really, it gives you a sliver of experience that's beyond what we can have with just the English language or just some music. It makes it more than, it's sort of a symbiotic thing.
I love the poetry of Mary Oliver. That's especially cool to me that they're using that. I would imagine that her poetry must have inspired other groups too. I bet if you dug through the Simply Folk in the Classical Library, there'd be some other things there.
I would think so, although this is the first one that I've encountered of Mary Oliver's poetry, but her stuff is just wonderful. Yeah, When I'm Among the Trees, that's one of my favorites. Oh.
We're talking to WPR's Stephanie Elkins, looking at music, mostly folk music, a little classical too, inspired by the world of poetry. And I want to come back to Wisconsin now. Yada, am I pronouncing that right?
Well, his website is Yada Yada. Y-A-T-A-Y-A-T-A, Yada Penovich.
And tell us about, before we give a listen, tell us about the poetry behind the song we're going to hear.
Well, it's all based on the poetry of William Butler Yeats, and he's another one who's created an entire CD based on one poet's work, and it's called Mad as the Mist and Snow, and he's set a number of poems of Yeats, and he's also worked with Walt Whitman and a lot of other poets, but the songs all have a different character, and again, he's really taken the poetry and tried to express it through music. He's got this beautiful kind of tenor voice, and he's also a guitarist, and there are some harmonies, and he's using these to express the music really well. This one that we're going to hear, I think, is about aging, and it's the words start at bolt and bar the shutter, for the foul winds blow, and the foul winds are our age that nobody escapes.
Well, let's give a listen. Yada Penovich, Mad as the Mist and Snow.
Bolt and bar the shutter, for the foul winds blow, our minds are at their best this night, and I seem to know
So kind of like the eggplant heroes there, pushing back against the changing of the seasons, the aging of ourselves. Wait, are you telling us something about where you are right now, Stephanie, about winter coming?
I was thinking about that after the fact that two of these songs really are about aging, and I'm in my mid-50s, and you're starting to think about all these autumn songs and into winter. Well, maybe so, maybe so. You know, you think about it, nobody escapes in this time of year as we're losing all the leaves from the trees and the cold is coming. We're going to get a widespread frost, you know, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And our minds start to go to that place.
But Stephanie is hopeful because the last song that she left us with is called The Thing with Feathers. And in this case, we're referring to Hope, the Emily Dickinson poem.
That's right.
So you've got hope, Stephanie.
That's absolutely right. And that's such a great poem by Emily Dickinson, probably one of her very best known. And in this case, the song is not set, the poem is not set in its entirety. It's just the inspiration. Mm. So the title of the song is Thing with Feathers, but the lyrics are entirely different. And the hook in it is Fly to Me, I've Been Waiting So Long, Fly to Me, Come and Give Me Your Best Song. And this is by a group called Mouth of Babes. It's a duo, Ingrid Elizabeth and Ty Greenstein. And she used to be with Coyote Grace and Girly Men, respectively. And they're based in Chicago. And they just got married recently, two women, and one's Jewish and one's Catholic. And so they were on MTV. They made a big splash of, you know, sort of a modern-day wedding. But their music is just great. And this particular song is, it is hopeful.
Mouths of Babes and Thing with Feathers.
And we hope somehow it would just get better.
And Stephanie, just the tip of the iceberg here. You were encountering tons of music with this sort of poetry connection.
I had a stack of 20 CDs and just fantastic music to listen to. The choices were really hard because the music was so good. A lot of slow ballad-type music, so it was thought-provoking music and really beautifully done music.
Well, Stephanie, so much fun. Thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's just great. Nice to share music.
That was Stephanie Elkins, host of WPR's Simply Folk and Morning Classics.
President Obama announced today that he's going to halt the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan and instead maintain the United States presence through the rest of his presidency. Here's what he had to say.
I'm therefore announcing the following steps, which I am convinced offer the best possibility for lasting progress in Afghanistan. First, I've decided to maintain our current posture of 9,800 troops in Afghanistan through most of next year, 2016. Their mission will not change. Our troops will continue to pursue those two narrow tasks that I outlined earlier, training Afghan forces and going after al-Qaeda. But maintaining our current posture through most of next year, rather than a more rapid drawdown, will allow us to sustain our efforts to train and assist Afghan forces as they grow stronger.
Joining us now is Jeremy Suri, the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Hi, nice to be on.
Was this announcement from the White House today a surprise, or were people expecting that we might see something like this?
I think there was a lot of expectation surrounding the possibility that President Obama would say this. The recent uptick in various insurgent activities in Afghanistan has led many people to, I think, advise the president to leave American soldiers in Afghanistan a little longer. So this was not a surprise today.
And what's your reaction to the shape that this plan has taken, essentially maintaining the current presence in Afghanistan through most of 2016, about half of that, a little more than half of that, into 2017?
Well, it's an effort to try to maintain stability without increasing America's on-the-ground commitment, but it is slowing down the withdrawal that the president has promised. So it's a middle position. It's a position that probably takes minimal risks, but it doesn't promise any solution to the problem in the long term. So it's a kind of holding strategy.
Now, 14 years of American presence there, the longest war, if we're defining it as a war still, in American history. Is there some point where we would say, you know, we haven't completed the mission, Afghanistan is not stabilized, it's not a safe place, but we've just got to stop leaving troops here now?
Well, that's possible, though the truth is, Rob, that our history is such that we tend to leave soldiers, small numbers in places where we've been. There are about 60,000, 65,000 American soldiers in Europe to this day. Most of them are there from the end of World War II. There are about 80,000 or so in East Asia. So we do tend to leave in various countries like Korea and Germany, places where it has, in fact, seemed to have worked to some extent, our efforts, or at least that things have improved from where they were years ago. We still tend to leave our soldiers there for all kinds of reasons. So it's very possible to imagine a small number of American soldiers, maybe fewer than 10,000, but perhaps more than a few hundred, in Afghanistan many, many years from now.
And there's been a contrast people have made, including critics of the president, to the withdrawal from Iraq, essentially a complete withdrawal from Iraq and then the rise of ISIS and the situation we see now. Did that lesson maybe inform this decision in Afghanistan?
Well, I think to some extent it did. Things in Iraq have gotten worse, especially the last year or so since our forces left. And I think that was not just a strategic pressure on Obama. There was a domestic political pressure surrounding that. But I don't think that's the entire explanation here. I think the concern in Afghanistan is the rise of ISIS, the continued presence of the Taliban, and the concern that Afghanistan will yet again become a terrorist training ground. And that's really what's driving this decision.
Talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas Austin about the announcement from the president today of a continued military presence, American military presence in Afghanistan. One of the missions the president mentioned there was the continued training of Afghan troops. Now, the Taliban attack on the city of Kunduz recently showed that the Afghan military and police aren't where I think people hoped they would be. It was kind of similar to the situation in Iraq and Mosul, where faced with a threat, faced with attack, ISIS in that case, Taliban this time, the army was not prepared. A lot of the troops seem to have broke and run. How much more training can the American military provide to turn that around?
That's a great question, Rob. I'm skeptical, as I think most people who look at this are, that we can train the Afghan army to be a reliable, uncorrupt security force in the near future. The real hope is that we can work with the leader of Afghanistan now, Ghani, President Ghani, who does seem to be intent on building a functioning state of one kind or another, that we can work with him to build a variety of state institutions that will provide more stability. But it's hard to imagine training and actually having the kind of army that we would want to have in Afghanistan. And I think our policy has really moved away from that. I think the way to think about our military presence in Afghanistan for the next year is it's a police force. It's a rapid reaction force to move in and out of areas where there are growing threats. It's not an occupation force, nor is it a counterinsurgency force.
Now, back in 2011, to that point of corruption, you wrote that the government of Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan was corrupt, stood in the way of Afghan and American goals of building a stable nation. He, as you mentioned, is out as president. It sounds like you have higher hopes for the new leadership there.
I do. I think President Ghani really is committed to building a state. It's not that he's completely uncorrupt, but he's a former high-ranking member of the World Bank. He's a technocrat by background, more than a politician. He's not looking to enrich his family and his many cousins and various others through his authority. So this is not to say that he's a George Washington. He's far from that. But he is a state builder. And there's an opportunity there to have at least a better functioning state, or shall we at least say a better functioning set of cities, which are really the places where he rules. The countryside is largely outside of his rule. And we have to recognize that as a continuing problem.
I've read that part of a long story in Afghanistan is that urban-rural divide you just mentioned, a back and forth between technocrats, urban-oriented modernizing governments versus a reaction in the countryside. Can somebody like that urban-identified modernizing type of figure, have a hope of getting support in the countryside where the Taliban initially got its support?
I don't think that there's in the near future, Rob, we'll see a large nationalist outpouring of pro-Ghani sentiment, pro-Kabul sentiment in the countryside. But that's never really been there, as you said. But what we're looking for is quiescence in the countryside. Can the urban-based government buy off enough people in the countryside? Can it create enough stability? And can it contain the areas of warlord activity and keep some of the worst terrorist elements out? So it's those modest expectations. And I'm not sure those are achievable either, but they're more realistic than either the hope of building a functioning Western-style state or the hope that we could just leave and things will get better. Neither of those other two alternatives is feasible.
In that 2011 piece you wrote that I mentioned, you also talked about the risk of of atrocities. You said, we have turned a frustrating war into a breeding ground for American atrocities. The situation was different then. There was more of a nation-building mission in part on our troops, but we see combat missions, airstrikes, having incidents like the bombing earlier this month of a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz. Is the situation still ripe for a tragedy like that? War crimes, people in Doctors Without Borders are calling it, being attached to the American presence there.
Yes, and there's a lot to be worried about with what we saw with that strike on the Doctors Without Borders facility. This is the danger of trying to operate over the horizon, as experts call it, over from the air and from the sea alone, not on the ground. One of the hopes I think the Obama administration has is that by keeping a small presence on the ground, we can avoid the need for extensive air missions. We'll still run air missions there, but that we can avoid the need for extensive air missions, and we can also have better intelligence on the ground. Many of those soldiers who are on the ground are providing intelligence to us and to the Afghan government and to other NATO allies who are operating in the region as well. So the hope is to avoid that, but we should be realistic that this is the cost of continued warfare, and we are responsible for some of these atrocities, and this is something we have to consider when we are assessing our own policies.
To complicate matters still further, I want to talk about the role of Pakistan here. Initially, the Taliban were their clients, supported by Pakistan. They've maybe eluded Pakistani control, but there's talk that there's still support coming from that country for groups like the Taliban in Afghanistan. Do we have leverage on that country to help the situation in Afghanistan?
Well, we need leverage on Pakistan, and I'm glad you brought this up, Rob, because my criticism of the Obama policy would be less about the numbers of soldiers on the ground and more about the absence of a regional strategy to deal with precisely this problem, which is that the Pakistani government, particularly the Pakistani intelligence services, the ISI, are supporting the Taliban and supporting other violent terrorist elements in Afghanistan, and in some ways they're doing it with our money because we still provide aid to Pakistan. I think we do have leverage if we can figure out a way to use our aid to incentivize, or the threat of withdrawing our aid to Pakistan to disincentivize this continued behavior. And we have done that before. We did it in 2002, 2003. And that might be something we have to go back to. That requires a lot of diplomatic will on the part of the administration. But if we don't lean heavily on Pakistan, they're going to continue to support these bad elements in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Jeremy Suri, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, looking at President Obama's announcement this morning that the U.S. will keep its current level of troops in Afghanistan through at least the end of next year.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support the change in plan to halt the withdrawal of American troops? Why or why not? And how do you think this plays into the conflict in Iraq and Syria? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Jeremy Suri, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, talking about President Obama's announcement this morning that the country will keep its current level of troops in Afghanistan through the end of next year.
And you can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you support the president's decision? The war has lasted now 14 years. Where do you draw the line between what some have called endless war and maintaining hard-fought stability there? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller with Paul in Menominee Falls. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the professor for his time as well. As an ex-Marine, I'm concerned about American blood being spilled on foreign soil. If the president, who I supported and was very excited about the fact that we were going to pull out en masse, if the president can justify to us why we should be spilling blood on foreign soil, then he needs to justify that. Is that to keep a presence in the area? And if so, is spilling the blood of our servicemen worth keeping presence there in Afghanistan? And thanks for the great program.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Jeremy Suri, your thoughts on what Paul brought up there?
Well, I think Paul asks the essential question. Are we willing and do we think it's worth putting Americans at risk, as he says, spilling American blood for this? That's the case the president has to make. As I understand the case he's made, the argument is not that we are committed to nation building in Afghanistan anymore, but is that we're committed to creating a secure environment, an environment that at the very least will not create threats to us. And so this force that the president's leaving there, the blood that he's willing to risk, is blood in a policing fashion, policing the area and the way we police many different parts of the world, parts of Africa, parts of Asia, parts of Europe. And that's the case he's making. Now, it's up to us as citizens whether we agree or not, but he believes that we have an interest in having a police presence. That's really what this is. In the area, and he also believes we can minimize the risks to Americans. But as Paul points out, if you have troops on the ground, you're going to have American casualties. That's unavoidable.
And can you situate this around the world here? We've got a military presence, airstrikes in Syria and Iraq targeting ISIS. Boko Haram just announced that some American troops will go there in an advisory capacity. So having this police presence in these failed or failing states to prevent friendly spots from being created for terrorist organizations.
I think that's part of it, and it's also an effort to bolster groups that we think are offering a possibility, at least, of stability. That's what we were talking about with regard to President Ghani a few minutes ago in Afghanistan. It's not that we're under the illusion that in any of these failed states there's a George Washington hiding behind the mountains. It's more that we hope that our police presence can give some support to those forces which are trying to bring stability and some kind of reasonable governance to these areas, and we believe that's in our interest. And for the president, I think that's a relatively low risk to take for something that he sees as important to America's national interests.
Thanks to Paul for that call at 800-642-1234. And Jeremy, also getting to Paul's point again on American public opinion. President Obama came into office saying in large part he was going to get troops out of Afghanistan and Iraq. It's proved harder to do in Afghanistan than one might anticipate. Is there war fatigue here that might lead people to criticize, be unhappy with this new policy?
Well, there definitely is war fatigue in the United States, Rob. I think that's a perfect term for it. Americans have no stomach. There's no evidence that there's any stomach right now for use of force overseas in any way of any significance. And that'll change, but that, I think, is the reality. Even Republicans are not calling for American troops on the ground across the world for the most part. That said, war fatigue does not mean that Americans will oppose small numbers of our troops in various parts of the world. We have done this consistently, supported our troops in many parts of the world for the last 70 years, and I don't see any chance of that changing. Dwight Eisenhower ran for president in the 1950s saying he was going to withdraw American troops from Korea and Europe, and they're still there. Richard Nixon promised this, and they're still in Southeast Asia, our troops, in many areas. And this will be the same for Obama. Part of the lesson here is that it's a lot easier to get troops in than to get them out.
Talking to Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin, about the president's announcement this morning that the U.S. will keep its current level of troops in Afghanistan through the end of next year, a little more than half that in the following year. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts on the U.S. in Afghanistan at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's talk about the mission of the troops that are still there, Jeremy. And again, you wrote about the difficulties in defining that mission 4 years ago. Is it simpler? Is it more clear what exactly they're doing there now than it was, say, in 2011?
Well, I still don't think it's clear enough. And this returns to Paul's question. People need to know why they're risking their lives. And in what I saw the president say today and what I've read about this, I don't think he's made it entirely clear. But it is, I think, a little clearer than it was before. This is a strike force. This is a rapid reaction force. This is a policing force. They are not there to do nation building. They are not there to be occupants of the entire Afghanistan country. They are not there to be the military of Afghanistan. They're there to be a policing force. That still needs more clarification. There need to be rules of engagement that are clarified. There need to be other political aims that are clarified. But this is a narrower mission than what we had 4 years ago.
How about a non-military U.S. presence there? There was criticism after the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan ended. In hindsight, people said, hey, the U.S. should have been there. They should have helped Afghanistan build new institutions after the Soviet war. It might have helped avoid 9/11. It would have helped avoid the situation in Afghanistan. Is there an opportunity for economic development, stronger nation building, apart from the military presence?
Well, we are continuing to fund that. Afghanistan is still a recipient of large quantities of American money and treasure and all kinds of aid and development workers. And just as a factual matter, there were lots of American aid and development workers in Afghanistan after the Soviets left, too. What there wasn't in the period between 1988 and 2001, there were not American soldiers on the ground there, and there wasn't a very strong American diplomatic or military presence in the air. Today we have that. But there are two big differences today, Rob. One, the Afghan government of President Ghani has invited us. We are there by their invitation. He'd like us to have more troops on the ground. And second, our aid workers and others are being threatened by these violent groups in a way they're more directly threatened today in a way than they were in 1988-89. And so the military presence is to some extent hand-in-hand with the developmental presence.
In another piece you wrote back in 2011, you'd mentioned the need to nurture regional stability. We've talked about that a bit. You also said hedge our bets. Don't back just one horse in Afghanistan. At the time, that was Hamid Karzai. Do we need to be making connections with people outside of the current presidency of Afghanistan?
I think we do. I still think that we're always poorly served, Rob, when we put all our eggs in one basket and become dependent upon a particular government or a particular figure. And so I think we should be building connections, and these can be informal as well as formal, with various ethnic leaders, various tribal leaders in different parts of Afghanistan. This is what the Iranians do very well that we don't do as well because we're far away, we don't have the language skills, we don't have as many people on the ground. But I think we should be doing that, and as I understand it, that is what the American military is trying to do. Many of these soldiers on the ground there have developed area expertise, and they are building these cooperative, negotiated relationships with different tribal leaders. That's the sort of our military at its best. At its worst, our military is destroying things and blowing things up and creating resistance to the very things we want to support. So there's a little bit of both happening.
You mentioned Iran, another country with influence, at least in some parts of Afghanistani culture. Do you see this as a place where, despite the differences, there might be room for cooperation with Iran?
Well, we certainly agree with Iran on the desire not to see the Islamic State or ISIS getting more involved. And so I think there is a lot of informal cooperation. Hopefully there could be more informal cooperation on that. In addition, the Iranians are not particularly strong fans of the Taliban either. So it's similar to Syria in that we have some different interests from Iran, but we have some very similar interests, some compatibility of interests. And international politics is about working with strange bedfellows. I always remind people the Soviet Union was our ally in World War II, and Iran actually shares more interest with us in Afghanistan and Syria than Pakistan does. And so coming back to that excellent question you asked before, Rob, it might make a lot of sense for us to be trying to work through the Iranians more than through the Pakistanis.
Looking ahead, we're talking about current presence through the end of next year, 5,500 troops or so into 2017. Do you see it as a reasonable proposition, thinking about zero American troops in Afghanistan the next decade even?
Unlikely, I think. I think we're likely to see a small presence, less than 10,000, maybe less than 5,000. But before this announcement, President Obama was not talking about zero either. He was talking about 1,000 troops on the ground. My guess is it'll depend, of course, on what happens in the next few years. But I would guess that for the next 5 to 10 years, we'll have somewhere between 3,000 to 5,000 American soldiers on the ground. Again, you know, just to put this all in perspective, we still have forces in Germany since 1945. We have forces in South Korea that have been there since 1950. And those are places that are much more stable than we can imagine Afghanistan being anytime soon.
Jeremy, thanks as always for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Rob.
That's Jeremy Suri, Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, looking at President Obama's announcement this morning that the U.S. will keep its current level of troops in Afghanistan through the end of next year.